Okay, good morning, everybody. Let's make a start. Thank you so much for coming. Chodesh Tov. Be'ezrat Hashem, it should be a Chodesh of Bracha and Besurot Tovot. I'd like to thank our sponsorship for the 2024 academic year. The Shirim is sponsored Le'ilu Nishmois Brana Bas Branditz and Zelig Ben Kalman, Zichronim Livracha. It should be an Aliyah for the Neshamas, and we're very grateful for the sponsorship. Now, we have a task ahead of us. If I could ask you to just turn off your phones, please. I said last week that I was going to undertake this topic. Of course, this is, as I suspected it would, become more and more center of the news. It quickly became evident to me when I started preparing this. These are new shirim. I've not prepared these before. That you can't do this in one shir. This is going to have to be at least a two-part series, and it might have to be a three-part series. Next week, therefore, I'm afraid we won't have to be able to talk about Purim, but I'm sure you'll manage to find a glass of wine without me. The week after that is Purim, and the week after that we may finish this series if we don't get already onto Pesach, but we'll see. Let's make a start. There's a lot to say. I'd like to try and give as comprehensive a packet on this as I can. You'll see already today's sheet is 12 pages. So next time will be no less. Today's sources, quite a lot of them are in English. And I don't apologize for that because they were written in English. I'd like to quote quite extensively today from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who I didn't have a personal kesher with, although many of his Talmidim are my Rebbeim. There are a few issues to talk about. First of all, is it the right temperature in here?
No.
It's going to get hot, isn't it? Okay, just let's be aware of it. Maybe we should ask, open a little window. Okay. I'll leave you to decide if it gets too hot, if you could ask them to turn the air conditioning on. There are a few halachic issues to deal with here. As you well know, exemption from army service that is mostly, but not entirely, given to the Haredi community, and I'm going to define these terms, we'll have to assume that we know who we're talking about, is something which is very strongly defended by many in that community. We heard the Sephardi Chief Rabbi Rav Yosef talk about this in the last couple of days. And there are five or six different issues that come up in the sources to defend this current practice. Four of them are halachic. Two or three of them are agadic. We will talk about one of the halachic issues today. The halachic issues are basically what is a milchemet mitzvah and who has to go out and fight. That's number one. A second issue which we'll deal with next week is the Rambam has in his Mishneh Torah, which is a halachic work, at the end of Hilchot Shemitah, he has a piece that says that the Levim did not go out to fight because their job was holy work. They were Ovdei Hashem in other areas. And just like the Levim were set aside for that holy purpose, anyone else in the Jewish people who decides to be part of Shevet Levi can become part of that holy group, and they themselves will be free of the burdens of general society. That is often quoted as a source on this issue, and we'll have to look at that next week, together with another Rambam, who very clearly says that anyone who learns Torah all day and takes money for the community is committing a terrible Chilul Hashem. We'll have to put those two sources together and try and work out who he's talking about and how that applies, if at all, to the current situation. A third halachic issue is the statement, which may be halachic, and it is applied halachically in certain areas, which says that Talmidei Chachamim do not need protection because their Torah protects them. We'll talk about that maybe next week as well. We have to talk about what that means. What are the parameters of that? Does it mean it protects them? Does it protect everyone else as well? We'll talk about that. And there's a very heavily halachic issue, which is oisik b'mitzvah potam in a mitzvah. If I'm involved in one mitzvah, do I have to get pulled away to do another mitzvah, or do I continue in the mitzvah that I'm in? We won't be able to get into all the weeds of that, because it's a very highly complex topic, but we'll talk about it. And there are a few agadic statements as well, some of which we'll see today. It talks about Avraham Avinu, who was punished, and we were punished by having to go to Mitzrayim and be slaves, because he recruited Talmidei Chachamim to fight his war against the four kings. We'll have to see what that means. Is that a halachic statement? Does that have application? And many more as well. But today we're going to really talk about something which is often not talked about, and I think this is a mistake, which is the lechatchila stroke b'di'eved situation of Hesder. Meaning, whatever happens in terms of the way forward politically, it'll be some kind of Hesder arrangement that is done, a little bit like is done with the Dati Lumi Yeshivot, where there's a combination of learning and military service. That's, I'm sure, what will be proposed. And I want to talk about Rav Lichtenstein's approach to Hesder, which I think we should keep in mind, rather than just getting swept into a bandwagon of Shivyon Banetel, and we'll analyze what that might mean. We should look at maybe the Lechatchila side of it. I brought you on page one, which I'm not going to read now, because I'm sure many of you have looked at this before. The historical background to the Petorah, to the exemption for army service, starting in 1948, when Ben-Gurion agreed to give a Petorah to around 400 senior scholars, Torah scholars, on the basis of Toroso Umnoso, which is that their Torah is their whole life, their occupation, and he allowed that. He assumed that the problem would just go away as this old Eastern European model of the yeshiva, Haredi yeshiva bochrim, would eventually just die out. That did not happen, Baruch Hashem. And Menachem Begin, when he came in 1977, removed what was then a cap on this, the number of exemptions, and the number of exemptions began to rise quickly, to the point that rather than 400 scholars being exempted today, the current number in 2023-24 is 66,784 exemptions. Now, I can't guarantee those numbers. They were taken from research which was done by other agencies, but let's assume they're around about correct. Over the last 25 years, the Supreme Court has got involved, saying this is not lawful because it's discriminatory, and requiring the Knesset to pass laws. They passed in 2002 something called the Tal Law, which was designed to address this with a new system. Eventually, that was also struck down by the Supreme Court, that said it didn't work. And various coalitions over the last 7, 8, 9 years, depending on who is in the coalition, have either passed more, you know, progressive, as it were, legislation on this, or rolled it back. Until the point now, if you just go over the page, and again, I've given you more details, if you remember over the last 5 years, we had 4 elections in 5 years or something like that, 5 elections in 4 years, something like that. Nothing much got done. The current draft extension that was in place under the current legislation expired on the 31st of July, 2023. The cabinet then ordered the defense minister to delay conscription until March the 31st, 2024, which of course is coming very soon. But all of this happened before October the 7th. And then October the 7th happened, and everything changed. How it changed, we don't yet know. But that it changed, it definitely did. And change is coming, and how it will look, we'll have to see. What are our new military requirements? The army is saying we need way more people than we thought we needed a year ago. How does that work, and what do we need them to do? What is public opinion? How is all the men and women who've been in Miluim over the last 6 to 7 months, how will, or a bit less than that, but a long time, how will their opinions, voting patterns change? How has the opinion of the religious Zionist community shifted on this issue, given their very heavy involvement in the war and many of the losses that have been suffered in the war? How will the new political alignments work? Will there be a change in the Haredi attitudes in the community? Where will that come from? Will it come from the leadership? Will it come from the grassroots? Or everything will change. And there will be some people, like when you smash a plate, that you live in denial and you try and glue it together and hold it with rubber bands and pretend that somehow or other you can still have the plate that you used to have. But then at a certain point you realize, no, I'm sorry, there's a new system, there's a new paradigm, and who exactly will bring that in and how it will work remains to be seen. But let's just take a little bit of a historical look to start with. It's important to remember that at the beginning of the state in 1948, there were many strong positions against recruitment of yeshiva, bochrim, and Torah scholars from within the religious Zionist community as well. And I brought you two quotes here, one from Rav Moshe Charlap, who of course was the Rosh Hashiva of Merkez HaRav in 1948, and one from Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer was not one of the extremists in the old Yishuv in the 1940s. He was one of the middle ground, as it was seen. Let's have a look at Rav Charlap, number one. Ulezot da'atenu, this is our view, da'at Torah, this is the view of the Torah, da'at Torah. Shekol ben yeshiva yeda et tavkido hane'eman, every yeshiva boy should know his actual unit is liyot b'cheil Hashem. Cheil Hashem, you are military fighters in the Cheil Hashem, learning in yeshiva. Ve'ein alav shum chova lehityatzev, you have no obligation to sign up, lehavkid, lirashem, l'shum avodah shel pluga acher. You don't have any obligation to feel that you need to be in any other unit. You are in Cheil Hashem. Now, in that short quote, he doesn't say you're not allowed to, but he makes it clear that the role of Yeshiva Bochrim, which again was a small group in the 1940s, was in Cheil Hashem. However, Rav Issa Zalman came out more strongly about against this. Look at number two. I want to make this absolutely clear to all those who are learning the Beit HaMidrash. Bachurim, v'avrechim, b'nei yeshivot, she'al pi Torah kadosha, according to the Holy Torah, hitzaltanu mihamatzav hanora she'anu nimtzaim bo, the terrible state in which we find ourselves in the independence war in 48, Hashem yirachem, Hirak bischut Torah Takadosha, the Hatzalah, the ability to be saved from that is only in the schut of the Torah. And you can see therefore the comments that people make today are in a masorah, if you like, of these comments. And again, I'm bringing you Rav Meltzer. I'm not bringing you someone from an extreme position in the Yeshua Yeshat. The kol zman shekol shel Yaakov b'tzatzef b'batei knesios, all the time that the voice of Yaakov is in the batei knesios u'batei midrashot, ein yidei Esav shel tozbo, then the hands of Esav will not be able to succeed. Now, don't forget, the people, Rav Issa Zalman knows full well the horrors of the Holocaust. He's not living in a naive universe. They're living just a couple of years after all of the yeshiva bochrim in Eastern Europe and the yeshivot and the communities were completely wiped out by the Nazis, so he's not living in a naive universe. And I'm giving out a das Torah as a clear halacha. He goes further than Rav Chalap in the quote that I brought. He must not sign up. Not even for shmira. Not even to help shmira. Meaning, even when it comes to just standing a post locally with a gun to make sure for a few hours a day that nobody's attacking, you can't do that either. Forget about joining the army for years. You can't even do shmirah. And God forbid we should even doubt this. So we certainly shouldn't enter into agreements and look for ways out. Today the B'nai Yeshiva have an even bigger obligation because there's a war on. Right now, you have to learn even harder, learn even more. And this will give a shmira to all the Jewish people. Okay, very clear. Now, it's interesting. I heard from Rav Zev Weitman. Rav Weitman is the Rav Machshir of Tznuva and also the Rav of Alon Shvut, my Yishuv, and a very senior Talmid Chacham, that he heard from Rav Amital, Rav Yehuda Amital, who was the founding Rosh Hashiva of Har Etzion in the Gush. Rav Amital was a Talmid of Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. And Rav Amital received smicha from Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer, and Rav Amital married the granddaughter of Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. And at the time when he'd done all of those things, Rav Amital told Rav Weitman, who I heard from Rav Weitman, that he walked into a shir that Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer was giving. In 1948, Rav Amital was a Holocaust survivor. He came over, he fought in the Haganah, he joined the Haganah. He was involved in very active service in 1948. He walked in his madim, in his army uniform, to Rav Issa Zalman's shir, and Rav Issa Zalman turned around to his students and said, "We sit and learn Hilchas Milchama in the Rambam, but Yehuda, he lives it." How do you square the two? There's a number of different ways to square them, and I'm not going to go into that now. But that's a family story from the Amital family and the family of Issa Zalman. But nevertheless, he came out with a clear written pronunciation against it. In contrast to that, and I want you just to turn to the back page for a second of the appendix. Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. Rav Zevin, who was, of course, one of the founding fathers of the Encyclopedia Talmudit project, very much part of that. The front of the last page? Excuse me, page 11, thank you. Rav Zevin issued, in writing, a very clear piece which opposed the positions of Rav Chalap, of Rav Issa Zalman, and said it's absolutely essential that there is a yeshiva draft. Now, other people we'll see in a minute who were very much in favor of that were Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook and Rav David HaNazir, one of the students of Rav Cook, and we'll see what Rav Cook has to say about that in a minute. But originally, Rav Zevin didn't publish this under his own name. He published it under the Echad Me'a Rabbanim. Maybe it was just too hot to handle. But look at what he says. This was translated, and it's from a Tradition Journal. It was translated, I put it here earlier on in the sheet. The details are where you can find it. So he says as follows. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but let's read a few bits of it. The deepest respect and admiration is due to the rabbis and learned scholars of our holy city. But the question may nonetheless be asked. Teachers, our masters, how can this be justified? What is the source for exempting yeshiva students and Torah scholars from an obligatory war? Milchamed Mitzvah, we'll see what that is in a minute. Fought to defend Israel from those who come to destroy her, God forbid. How can you pass it off as if it was halacha or das Torah? Now, das Torah is a little bit manipulative. When you say the word das Torah, people feel that, you know, that everyone agrees on this. The yeshiva students need not register or serve. Have we not learned that when it comes to saving a life, not many lives, just one? These things are done by the leaders of Israel. Pikuach Nefesh is done by Gedolei Israel, by the scholars, in order to teach the halacha to the nation. He's saying Dafka the yeshiva bocherim should be fighting in the army. Dafka. Was any distinction made whether or not it's time of learning Torah that is to be lost? If this is the case in saving one life, how much more so in the saving tens of thousands of Jews? Now, perhaps a distinction should be made as to whether one must endanger himself in order to save someone else's life. Could we go so far as to say that if one's own life were threatened, he has no obligation to save other people? If so, where does the Torah differentiate between the self-sacrifice of the highest of the high and that of the lowest of the low? If a person should not have been drafted because of the danger involved, all of Israel is exempt. Why have you excused only the yeshiva students? How do you know that your blood is redder than that of your fellow man? Very strong statement. Mm-hmm. Well, what right do you have not to be part of the danger when everybody is in danger? How do you know that your blood is redder, etc.? There's no distinction to be taken between the blood of a Torah scholar and that of a common man. The rule that one life is not pushed aside for another applies even to a day-old baby. It is clear that up to now there had never been any controversy as to whether the principle that one must put his own life in danger to save another's applied only to saving an individual's life, or perhaps the lives of many individuals. But there is certainly no disagreement when it comes to saving Klal Yisrael. Surely there is no need to review the unanimous opinion that a defensive war fought to save Israel against their enemies is an obligatory one, of which it's been said, all must go, even a bridegroom from the room and a bride from under her chuppah. How have we arrived at the conclusion that scholars are not included in the obligation? If our generation merited everyone studying Torah, let's imagine the whole of Eretz Israel. Everybody was involved in Talmud Torah. What an amazing thing. Would we allow our enemies to ravage our land and kill our people without taking up arms to defend ourselves? We were not worthy, but thank God that there are people ready to stand firm and fight. What source have we for a hierarchy of obligation regarding participating in a war to save Israel from its enemies? And just turn over the page. I'm just going to read one other small paragraph. If you go on the right, on page 12, he says, I understand the feelings of Neturi Karta, who are unalterably opposed to the state of Israel. They oppose the war because they feel that we should surrender. Even according to these ideas, there's no difference between a yeshiva student and the common people. Meaning, they don't make a distinction between the yeshiva boys and the regular people. They just think everybody should surrender. Anyone who subscribes to this philosophy must be against the conscription of anyone in Israel, whoever he would be. Luckily, very few people feel this way. Our entire nation in Israel and in the diaspora eagerly risk their lives in this defensive war which has been thrust upon us. They understand well that there is no future for the yeshiva, for the yeshuv here, or for the refugees waiting in the diaspora without our own independent country, one that would be open to accept our bloody brothers who wander in the burning desert. God, Israel, and the rest of the world know that we are not the aggressors. We do not want war. We are not gladdened by the spilling of blood. But if our enemies fall upon us in a mad, killing frenzy, we must defend ourselves. And you, he's addressing the Rabbanim, our Gaonim, admit the dire necessity of this obligatory war. Many of you have sent blessings and words of encouragement to our valiant soldiers. It is your obligation to encourage young and healthy scholars to fight. Will you send your brothers to war and yourselves sit at home? Which is a pasuk from Moshe Rabbeinu. When the B'nai Gad and the B'nai Reuven, we'll see that pasuk inside, say, you know something, we're just happy to stay over here. He looks at them incredulous and said, now that we fought for your land, you're going to stay at home while the rest of Klal Yisrael fight? And you're not going to fight with them? How can that be? Anyway, Rav Zevin's piece, you should read the rest on your own. It makes very important reading. But you should know, even in the earliest days of the Yeshuv, this was a significant issue. Rav Herzog, the chief rabbi at the time, was very in favor of the yeshiva students being drafted. But then when the government suggested withholding food supplies to yeshiva students who wouldn't draft, he said, you can't do that. You can't starve people to force them to draft. And that, of course, is likely to be one of the discussions on the table as to, well, are we going to cut down the payments that we make to families in order to incentivize them to draft? And Rav Herzog said, no matter how important drafting is, starving families is not the way necessarily to do it. Again, I'm not making any personal comment on what we should or shouldn't do. There's no comparison. Because these people are literally starving. Yes, you're right, 100%. There's no comparison. You're right. Correct. 100%.
And distributed.
That's absolutely correct. It's a different situation. But no two situations are ever exactly the same. You're right. But there, 100%, people were literally starving. Today, people are not literally starving. But also, you know, today our standards of living are not what they were in the 1940s. And what people could live with in the 40s, people may not be able to live with today. Anyway, I brought you, and again, please don't, anything I say should not be interpreted, whichever way I say it, as my own personal opinion. You know, if you want my personal opinion, you can ask me personally. I'm not interested in putting it onto a shir which we broadcast around the world. I brought you on page 3, and I'm not going to read this. Rav Shai Yishuv Cohen, who of course some of you in this room may have known him personally, who was the son of Rav David HaNazir, and was a student at Merkaz HaRav. And he was confronted, he was signed up to fight, and he was confronted with a slogan on the wall that Rav Avraham Yitzchak, HaKohen Cook himself, said that it was not allowed for Yeshiva Bochrim to fight. And he ran through the streets, he couldn't believe it, and he saw Rav Tzvi Yehuda, he bumped into Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, and he said, is this true? Is it true that your father said also that Yeshiva Bochrim should never be drafted? If you look here at the last two paragraphs, under the pressure of his questioning, I told him about organizing a fighting yeshiva in the Jewish quarter, and my distress when I saw the announcements which indicated that we were acting against the guidance of Rav Cook. When he heard my words, Rav Tzvi Yehuda was horrified. He grabbed me by my shoulders and began to roar, this is a complete forgery, a distortion, an utter falsehood. He was so upset, his shouts echoed down the street. After calming down, he explained that his father had written the letter during the First World War regarding the draft of yeshiva students who'd escaped from Russia to England. Rav Cook felt that these students should be exempted from the draft, just as the British exempted other clergy students. But here, Rav Tzvi Yehuda continued with emotion, here we are fighting for our hold on the land of Israel and the holy city of Yerushalayim. This is undoubtedly a milchamit mitzvah, whereas in England the demand was yeshiva students should fight for a foreign army. Now, I actually brought you an extract from Rav Cook's letter in number 4 to Rav Hertz, the chief rabbi of Britain and the British Empire, I should say. Nearly said the Commonwealth by mistake. The British Empire at the time. And Rav Cook wrote to Rav Hertz, encouraging him, begging him to intercede to prevent the draft of yeshiva students from London into the British Army. One of the things he says there, which we'll have to come back to, make sure this is still going. Yeah, one of the things he says there, just underlined in number 4, he brings different gemarot One of which is that Avraham Avinu was criticized, as I mentioned before, for recruiting Talmidei Chachamim to fight the war against the four kings. And again, we're going to have to unpack that. What does that mean? What was it? Is that a gadot? It is an agadot. So how do we understand that? But if you look at what Rav Kook does say there, he says underlined, V'yotel mizera'inu et gedulat ha'isur. We've seen how great is the prohibition la'asot angaria, to make a draft of Talmidei Chachamim l'kaifam al yitzia l'milchama, to force them to go out to war. Afilu al milchemet mitzvah gedolah ma'od. Even for a very, very big milchemet mitzvah, yeshiva students mustn't go out to war.
It doesn't say yeshiva students.
Oh, very nice. I accept your correction. It's a very accurate one. He says Talmidei Chachamim, and that is a point that we will need to address. And Rav Aaron Lichtenstein will address that next week, when we see his piece response to this tribe of Levi argument, and we say, who does this actually apply to? That's an excellent point. But we have to work out what to do with Rav Kook. Rav Kook was writing in England in 1916. What would Rav Kook have said in 1948 in defending Eretz Yisrael? So Rav Tzvi Yehuda, his son, is no question. He said this was for then, and now he would not say anything like this. Yes, sir? No, he's talking about Avraham Avinu. When Avraham Avinu was fighting, because that's the next line. I didn't read the next line. Shehari ein lecha milchamit mitzvah yoteh gedol me'amilchet she'erech Avraham Avinu ad neged amalachim. He's not saying the World War One is a milchamit mitzvah, in case you're asking that. Although, he did have a lot to say about World War One, which we're not going to talk about now. So, just introducing those different voices, you can see there is a certain fog of war, even in the opinions about war. And that is the nature of things, and people are always going to bring the quotes from people they wish to support them, even if those quotes have to be examined more carefully as to what was their context. Let's have a look at a fundamental question which we need to, which I want to bring in Rav Aaron Lichtenstein to talk about. Is the army a good place for a yeshiva bocha? And here I do mean a yeshiva bocha. Yeah, the guys they're drafting in from yeshivas, 18, 19, these are young men, they learn Torah, they're not fighters. Do we say that this should be a place for them? So let's have a look. If you look in Shmuel Bet at the end, at number 5, there's a pasuk in Shmuel Bet that goes through the different fighting personalities in David HaMelech's army. These are the names of David's, you know, valorous, glorious men. Yoshev b'shevet tachkamoni rosh hashlishi. There's a debate as to whether that's the name of a person, Yoshev b'shevet, or sitting in with the wise, the rosh hashlishi, which is the head of a part of the army. You can look in the different parashanim there. Who is this person? Who adino ha'etzni? This fellow adino ha'etzni, who was famous for what? Al shmona ma'od chalal b'pam achad. He took down 800 warriors with one sword, with one arrow. Okay, who is this fellow? Adino ha'etzmi. So if you go over the page to page 4, Chazal take this to be a reference to David HaMelech himself. And rather than reading this as a list in the pshat of the different generals, all these expressions are about David. So look at what it says in number 6 from Moed Katan. My ka'ama, what's being said here? Amar Rabbi Bi'aba u'hachir ka'ama, this is what it's saying. The ele shmot gvuratav shel David. This is how we praise David. This is what we look up to in David himself. Hu adino ha'etzni. He is the adin, and yet he's the etzni. Kesheha yoshev ba'osek b'torah. When he was sitting and learning Torah, haya ma'aden atzmo ketolat. He was as soft and gentle as a worm. You could have just pressed him and exploded. He was a yeshiva bocha in learning Torah. U'b'sha sheyotzeh le'milchama. But when he had to take off his whatever, Torah clothes, and put on his army clothes, he was as strong as a wood. And he talks about the 800 people that he would kill, he would shoot an arrow, and he would take down 800, and he would regret he didn't get the other 200. And he brings that from a pasuk as well. In other words, Chazal see in the personality of David himself, not a yeshiva bocha, or a fighter, but both. He was both, and he was both with extreme success. And that was an ideal. Mashiach himself, if we look in number 7, Rambam says in Yamud Melech Beis David, how do we know it's going to be Mashiach? Hogeh b'Torah, has to be very learned in Torah, v'osek b'mitzvot k'David Aviv, again, like David, k'fi Torah b'chtah, shibichtah, v'bal peh, v'yilcham milchamot Hashem. And he also needs to be a warrior. Now, you could turn around and say milchamot Hashem may mean spiritual wars. And of course, the Lubavitcher Rebbe took this idea to its next stage, and the, what is the youth group of Chabad? Little boys, I don't know if they've got girls as well, probably haven't, Chabad. Sivas Hashem, the armies of Hashem. So Milchamot Hashem may not be, as on some views, literal, but the Rambam, I think, clearly is seeing it as an actual battle. There's a model of a Mashiach who is a Lomed Torah and also a Gibor Chayal. Look in the Ramban in number 8, I'll mention it outside. The Ramban says, why was Avimelech so keen to make a treaty with Avraham and Yitzchak? He says, because they were Giburei Chayal. He'd seen what they could do. He'd seen how Avram had smashed the four kings. He was nothing compared to the four kings. And therefore, the personality the Ramban is telling us of Avraham and Yitzchak that the Torah is presenting is not only all the other things we always learn about Avraham and Yitzchak, their spiritual sensitivities and the Akedah, etc., but also their ability to be Giburei Chayal. And the Ramban wants us to know that and understand that this is the Jewish way. And therefore, Rav Lichtenstein, for who we're going to give over the next 10 minutes or so of the Shia to, Rav Lichtenstein says, number 9, although stateless centuries have tended to obscure this fact, Hesder has been the traditional Jewish way. What were the milieu of Moshe Rabbeinu?
Someone's phone is ringing.
It may be outside. Well, it won't ring for long. I think we just have to ignore it.
Okay,
because otherwise we'll be searching everybody's bags for the phone. Although stateless centuries have tended to obscure this fact, Hesder has been the traditional Jewish way. What were the milieu of Moshe Rabbeinu, Yeshua, David, Rabbi Akiva, as Chazal conceived and described them, but Yeshivot Hesder? Rabbi Akiva had a Hesder Yeshiva. They were fighting the war of Bar Kokhba and they were learning Torah. And therefore, what I want to talk to you about for the next few minutes is this idea of Hesder. And some important points that Rav Lichtenstein brings out, because we often get swept up into the secular narrative of Shivyon Banetel, but actually that is not a perspective that the religious Zionist community supports, this idea. And we'll see, in a sense, why that is. There is an idea of a lechatchila in a bidyevet situation. I remember when our son went into Hesder, he went to the Haaretz Zion, Rav Lichtenstein Yeshiva, and when they called all the parents in for the, you know, your son's going into Hesder, I think Rav Moshe Lichtenstein said, this is a lechatchila solution to a bidyevet situation. And there is a lechatchila element to this, which we need to understand. Look in number 10. Optimally, Hesder doesn't merely provide a religious cocoon for young men, fearful of being contaminated by the potentially secularizing influences of general army life, although it incidentally serves this need as well. Hesder at its finest seeks to attract and develop Bnei Torah who are profoundly motivated by the desire to become serious Talmidei Chachamim, but who concurrently feel morally and religiously bound to help defend their people and their country, who, given the historical exigencies of their time and place, regard this dual commitment as both a privilege and a duty, who, in comparison with their non-Hesder confrères, love not, to paraphrase Byron's Child Harold, Torah less, but Israel more. I can't resist. I could read this all day, honestly. I was shocked to find that on a website, Rav Lichtenstein's article had been printed out, had been brought down, but it's been dumbed down. It had taken out a lot of the, you know, expressions that he uses. You read Rav Lichtenstein not just for the content, but also for the style, mainly for the content. It provides a context within which students can focus upon enhancing their personal, spiritual, and intellectual growth, while yet heeding the call to public service, and it thus enables them to maintain an integrated Jewish essence. Now, again, this is going to be a hard sell to the Haredi community, but they don't know this Torah. They haven't learned this Torah. They haven't thought this through in this way. And of course, this is a religious Zionist manifesto in the sense that it seeks to balance things as a Jew in the modern world. And he sees in this sense the idea of army service not as kind of schlepping you away from Torah to do something else, but to actually take you from Torah to enhance your Jewish religious personality in a certain way. Number 11. When the Mishnah states, if there's no flour, there's no Torah, and if there's no Torah, there's no flour, it hardly means that both are equally important. Let's not lose sight of it now. What it does mean is that both are in fact equally necessary, although axiologically and teleologically, flour exists for the sake of Torah and not vice versa. Il faut manger pour vivre. Il ne faut pas vivre pour manger. Okay? Which he translates. You don't live to eat, you eat to live. He claims one of Molière's characters. And so it is with the Hesder. The yeshiva prescribes military service as a means to an end, and that end is the enrichment of personal and communal spiritual life. The realization of the great moral and religious version, and maybe it should mean vision, whose fulfillment is our national destiny, and everything else is wholly subservient. No one responsibly connected with any yeshiva Hesder advocates military service per se. We avoid even the slightest tinge of militarism. No less than every Jew, the typical Hesdenik yearns for peace, longs for the day on which he can divest himself of his uniform and Uzi and devote, they don't have an Uzi anymore, but you know what I mean, and devote his energies to Torah. In the interim, however, he harbors no illusions. He keeps his powder dry and his musket ready. Rav Lichtenstein lives in the 17th century in his mind. Okay? In terms of his mind process. Go over to page 5. Again, I make no apology for reading some of this out quickly, but it's important. And this next piece is very important, number 12. In one sense, therefore, insofar as an army service is alien to the ideal Jewish vision, Hesder is grounded in necessity rather than choice. If you wish, b'dieved, it is, if you wish, a b'dieved, a post-facto response to a political reality imposed upon us by our enemies. In another sense, however, it is very much l'chatchila, a freely willed option grounded in moral and halachic decision. We at Yeshivat Haritzion, at any rate, do not advocate Hesder as a second best alternative for those unable or unwilling to accept the rigors of single-minded Torah study. We advocate it because we are convinced that given our circumstances, would that they were better, military service is a mitzvah, and a most important one at that. Without impugning the patriotism or ethical posture of those who think otherwise, we feel that for the overwhelming majority of B'nai Torah, defense is a moral imperative. Of course, that concern must be balanced against others. Knesset Yisrael needs not only security, but spirituality, and ultimately the former for the sake of the latter. Spirituality is more important. Those who, by dint of knowledge and inspiration, are able to preserve and enrich our moral vision and spiritual heritage, contribute incalculably to the quality of our national life. And this must be considered in determining personal and collective priorities. Hence, while we of Yeshivat Hesder feel that training and subsequent reserve status for men should be virtually universal, spiritual specialization being reserved at most for the truly elite cadre, and that's the point that you made over there, the length of post-training service should be justifiably briefer than that of those unable or unwilling to make a comparable spiritual contribution. Now, what did he say there? Very important. Before you jump into the Shivyon Benetel issue, think about the meaning of those two words. First of all, he doesn't address this here, he addressed it before. What does Shivyon Benetel mean? Equality of burden. Now, as religious Jews, to call army service in the IDF a burden is unacceptable. It's an obligation, a duty, a responsibility, a challenge, maybe even an opportunity, but a burden? A burden as if it's like taking out the garbage? That's an unacceptable word for us to use, netel, a burden. We don't see it as a burden. We wish we didn't have to do it. But now that we have to do it, it's an opportunity and a duty and an obligation. It's a very different kind of mindset. And what about Shivayon? Are we in favor of equality? The problem with equality is you can't have a fair system if everybody is equal. And I'll tell you what I mean. We don't have equality of army service. Men serve longer than women. Men serve for 3 years, roughly. Women serve for 2 years. Why is there no equality there? So you say, no, of course. I mean, that's the obvious reasons why women have to serve less. I don't know, are there obvious reasons? Are there other considerations? What about many of the people in this room, I'm sure, have children, grandchildren, young women who did Shirut Lumi. Chiloni, non-religious Israeli girls, do not get a choice to do Shirut Lumi. They have to go to the army. And if they say, I'd rather do Shirut Lumi, they're told, well, I'm sorry, you're not dati, you can't do it. Now, there's no equality there. If you are pushing for equality, then very soon you'll be told, well, all your girls have to also join the army, and Shirut Lumi is not an acceptable option. Why should this daughter have to fight, or do whatever she does in the army, and this daughter do something else. Now, you could say, well, Shiur Lemi is critically important, and I'm not denying that. But Shivyon is a dangerous word. And Rav Lichtenstein also referred to this in terms of the Hesdi yeshivas. Many of your sons, grandsons, my son, went to a Hesdi yeshiva. So in a Hesdi, we're very proud of the boys in a Hesdi yeshiva, but they don't serve for 3 years. And they won't serve for 3 years. Because as Rav Lichtenstein says, what they do in the yeshivot is also important. There's no equality there. If we fly the banner of Shivyon, then very soon that banner will be applied in ways that a lot of people will find unacceptable. So we just have to be a little bit careful as to how we apply equality, because equality is, as we saw after the French Revolution, equality, I'm not saying it's going to be exactly the same, we're not going to bring back a guillotine, but equality is a difficult thing. And not a fair one either. So just want to mention that. I would prefer a different expression, not Shivyon Menetel, maybe, I don't know, something Bechova, or Tzedek Bechova. I don't know. No one's asking my opinion on that. But I don't like Shivyon Menetel. Number 13, says Rav Lichtenstein, the case for Hesda rests then on simple assumptions. Firstly, during the formative post-secondary years, a Ben Torah should be firmly rooted in a preeminently Torah climate. This being crucially important both for his personal spiritual development and the future of a nation in critical need of broadly based spiritual commitment and moral leadership. Think about the mechinot. The boys who go to mechina come out of mechina after a year, sometimes 2 years, although I think they're cutting that back, much more mature, much more able to, but it's not shivyon, it's not equal, not everybody is going to mechina. Second, the defense of Israel is an ethical and halachic imperative, because as we believe the birth of the state was a momentous historical event and its preservation of great spiritual significance, or because even failing that, the physical survival of its 3 million, and I've added in Blian Hara, now over 7 million Jewish inhabitants is at stake. And third, in light of the country's current military needs, and these should be admittedly be reassessed periodically, yeshiva students should participate in its defense, etc., etc. All of these are very important points. We could go on, and I'm just going to mention one more thing. He brings in a number 14. Service enables the religious community as a whole to avoid both the reality and the stigma of parasitism. He's very aware of this. There's a reality and there's also a stigma. It helps build personal character on the one hand, open channels of public life on impact on the other, by producing potential leaders attuned to the pulse and experience of their countrymen. To be sure, the prospect of secular criticism should not routinely be the decisive factor in determining religious policy. We don't change our religious policy because the secular world jumps up and down and screams. Nevertheless, it cannot be totally ignored. Chazal, at any rate, did not regard Chilul Hashem and Kiddush Hashem lightly. And he's very conscious. And Rav Herzog also wrote, I brought you in the note at the bottom, although I didn't bring you the whole piece, in 1948, in favor of the yeshiva draft. And he said, because what will happen if the yeshiva men are not drafted, even if we feel that there is an enormous contribution that they're making through learning Torah, the secular world will not understand that. And there will be enormous Chilul Hashem, and it will lead to a terrible rejection of Torah and a hatred of Torah amongst people that are chiloni. And again, that can't be the only consideration, but to not bring it into the consideration is unacceptable. Rav Lichtenstein is trying to balance that. On page 6, and I want to get back into the Hebrew sources quickly, I brought you here in number 6, the Rav Lichtenstein deals with the dangers of eroding religious commitments in numbers 15 and 16. One of the main arguments that the Haredi community advances is that the army will be very, very bad for the religious observance, level, commitment, dedication of many of their boys. Now, you could turn around and say, well, I mean, that's a situation that you should have thought through, and you're not, you know, giving them enough understanding of why they want to be. Okay, that's fine. But that's a little bit like the fellow coming to the door collecting for his 9 children who've got no money because they've got no jobs, and me saying, well, you know, you should have thought about before you got that into that system. It's the system that's... Okay, the system is at fault, but that doesn't help this fellow when he's got no money, and he is almost as much a victim of the system as everybody else. Nevertheless, Rav Lichtenstein is very keenly aware of the attrition and the negativity that the army has on religious life. And it does. And anyone who's had family in the army, for all that we support and want to be part of the Kiddush Hashem of being in the army, it is very draining. And it's not because they can't keep Shabbat. They have lots of poskim in the army that are very clear on what they can do and can't do on Shabbat, and the army won't force them into do things which are against halakha. And the kitchens are glatt kosher. Don't worry, it's the kosherest kitchen you ever ate in the army. Because if the mashgiach messes it up, he won't get fired. He'll get put in jail. So the kitchen's fine, and the Shabbos, the problem is that being in the army, and this was my experience, I was never in the army, just, you know, full disclosure. I came on Aliyah when I was in my mid-30s. When I asked them about the army, they smiled at me and they said, "You want to help Israel? Maybe you join the Syrian army." So I felt that sarcasm was not helpful in my Aliyah process. But nevertheless, our son, Baruch Hashem, was in the army. And being in the army necessarily takes over every single cell in your brain. You have to be a small cog in a very big wheel. You have no time for broader thinking, for deeper thinking. And every minute that you're not busy doing what you have to do, you're exhausted and you just flop down on the floor. That's how it is. Now, I'm not saying it can be any other way, because that's how the army needs to train its and use its soldiers. But there's no room for that lifestyle, in that lifestyle, for religious growth in the way that we, you know, understand it. And therefore, it has to be understood that it's very, very difficult to get that right. And Rav Lichtenstein understands that. Just looking at number 16, let's skip number 15. Like all yeshivada, yeshivat hesder seeks to instill a love for Torah so profound and so pervasive as to render protracted detachment from it painful. And yet it demands precisely such an absence. It is painful to join the army, but we demand it, he says. It advocates patriotic national service even at some cost to personal development, and yet prescribes that students serve considerably less than the non-yeshiva peers. These apparent antinomies are the result of the basic attempt to reconcile conflicting claims and duties by striking a particular balance, one which should produce an aspiring Talmid Chacham who also serves rather than as a soldier who also learns, but one who perceives military... Sorry, I said that wrong. He produced a Talmid Chacham who also serves, rather than a soldier who also learns. One which perceives military service as a spiritual sacrifice. We don't want students to be indifferent to their loss, but which proceeds to demand that sacrifice. One which encourages a Hesdenik to excel as a soldier while in the army, but prescribes his return to the Beit Midrash before that excellence is fully applied, or perhaps fully attained. And this is another side of the coin. You put a young man in an army, we'll talk about men for now, and they do really well in the army, and they excel in their service, and they're ready to sign on to be more, to do an officer training. You say, nope, back to the Beit Midrash. So in a sense, you're cutting them back from excelling even in their army service, which many boys will find difficult too. From the yeshiva's perspectives, these antitheses are fully justified, and they constitute the very essence of Hesder as a complex and sensitive balance. However, preserving that balance with its multiple subtle nuances entails traversing a narrow ridge. And here lies the primary difficulty, existential and not just practical of Hesder. Small wonder that many only achieve the balance imperfectly. It is, however, in those who do succeed in attaining the balance and who, despite the difficulty, are genuinely at peace with themselves that Hesder at its finest can be seen. And it is inspiring to behold. And in this, Rav Lichtenstein unquestionably is coming from his background in Yeshiva University. Because don't forget, YU also walks a very narrow bridge. And that world of centrist orthodoxy, which is a different bridge. It's not a bridge of religious Zionism, it's a bridge of modern orthodoxy or centrist orthodoxy, which also tries to balance two very important things in a way which will, of necessity, sometimes have casualties. And some people will not do them properly and will fall along the wayside. You know, Rabbi Nachman said it, everything is a geshet tzar ma'od. And you have no choice but to wash down the Geshe Samu Od, because the alternative is a world of pretense and denial, that you don't live in conflict. And Rav Soloveitchik actually has a piece which I didn't bring you, we could have gone on forever today, but we won't go on forever, where Rav Soloveitchik talks about modern orthodoxy as two mountains, with a narrow bridge between them. There's the Torah and there's the Mada. And he brings from Shmuel Hanavi, who lived al Ramataim, on two mountains, not one. And he paints this picture of these Wayu Bochrim walking this narrow bridge between Torah and Mada, and some falling off down into the ravine as they go. And he said, I have sleepless nights at the reality that people do sometimes stumble and don't succeed in this synthesis, but what can I do? I can't deny that that is the way we have to be. So Rav Lichtenstein, of course, who was son-in-law Rav Soloveitchik, who was the Rosh Yeshiva to be at Yeshiva University before he, much to the dismay and excitement of many in the 1970s before he made Aliyah, and I don't know if that was, you know, expected, and you can now speak to people who are more in the YU frame, but he's coming from that. That religious Zionism is in itself this tense synthesis. Whenever you have a hyphenated hashkafa, it's always tricky. You know, it's easy just to be yeshivish. Whatever that means, nobody, you know, whatever. Haredi, it's great. But once you're modern slash or dash orthodox, or religious dash Zionist, you've introduced a tension, a dialectic, which of course, if you're Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Soloveitchik, means you're actually living life, but which causes a lot of challenges. Anyway, enough of that for now. Let's get back into some of the issues. Milchemet Mitzvah. For the next 10 minutes, let's dive into these sources. What we don't get through today, I will bring you Be'ezrat Hashem next week. We know that certain people are sent back. That's source number 17. Those people, well, let's leave the posseg. So the soldiers, the officers go to speak to the people. The only one they say, says the Torah, anyone who is scared and weak-hearted, let him go home. And not undermine the morale of other people. What does that mean? Source number 18. Page 7. Says the Mishnah. Rabbi Akiva Omar, Harai Barach Levav, Kamashmo, literally, anyone who is scared is sent home. She'en yochal la'amod b'kishra milchama, l'irot chev v'shlufo. He can't cope with the terrors of war. Rabbi Yosei Aglili Omar, Harai Barach Levav, what does he mean, who is scared? It's scared of mitirei min ha'averot shebiyado. He's scared of his averas. He won't be able to succeed because he's not enough of a tzaddik. Rabbi Yosei Omar, Almana lekohen gadol, grusha v'chalutza lekohen hedyot. I'll give you two examples. He holds it's only Torah averas, and the two he points out are two which you might hold to be slightly lesser or unusual or not standard averas, not necessarily lesser, but a kohen who marries a grusha. That's the kind of person, says Rabbi Yossi, who has to go home. Even that level of avera, he's not going to be able to fight properly. Now, says the Mishnah then, b'ma devarim morim, when are we sending people home? B'milchemet reshut. Aval b'milchemet mitzvah. But when it comes to a milchemet mitzvah, hakol yotzim, everybody has to go. Afilu chatan mechedro v'kala mechupata. Even the chatan v'kala are schlepped away from the chupa, and we've seen in this war and in previous wars. Chatan and kala, who delayed their weddings, who were taken away the day after their weddings from the Sheva Brachot. I know personally many cases of this. And I brought you in the references here for one of the previous Gaza wars, one of the Chatanim who was so badly injured, only a day or two into his wedding. We even take the Chatan and the Kala away. Fine. A couple of things before we go on. The example of the Kohen marrying a Grusha, you see from here that the Kohanim were in the war. We're going to have a discussion next week about whether they called up the Kohanim. Well, this Mishnah sounds like they did call up the Kohanim, because the Kohanim were some of the people who they sent home, if they were a naughty Kohen. Okay, fine. So we'll just remember that. How do we define a milchemet mitzvah? So there are a number of different ways to approach it. The Gemara in Sotah says some things are clear. Milchamot Yoshua lichvosh, the milchama of Yoshua to capture the land of Israel, divrei hakol chova. Okay, that's definitely chova. Let's assume that means the same as mitzvah. It's not so straightforward, but let's assume that. Milchamot Bedavid Ravacha, David's wars to expand his kingdom, they weren't necessary for defensive purposes. That is Rishut. Okay? That livery I call Rishut. Ki pligi, but where there's a debate, is a war lemiute of de kochavim de lo leise alayu. A war where we need to preemptively weaken an enemy so that they won't cause us trouble in the future. One of you says this is a milchamit mitzvah, and one of you says this is a milchamit Rishut. But what about a war which is not to preemptively weaken, but to actually defend ourselves after attack. So there the Lecha Mishnah brings down, I brought you in the footnotes, there everybody agrees it's a milchamet mitzvah. It's a milchamet mitzvah. What could be more of a milchamet mitzvah than coming to the defense of Klal Yisrael? And in fact, the Rambam, when he defines that, if you look in number 21, Ein amelech nilcham tchila ela b'milchamet mitzvah. The king is only allowed to go out and fight without permission from the Sanhedrin, etc., in a milchamet mitzvah. The eizahi milchamet mitzvah. What is a milchamet mitzvah? He gives three options. Milchamet shivat ha'amim, the war of Yeshua against the seven nations. Okay, that's historical. Milchamet Amalek, which we talked about 2 weeks ago, whether that is or isn't historical. And the third, the Ezrat Yisrael miyatzar sheba aleihem, saving the Jewish people from an enemy who has attacked them. So that's not preemptively weakening where there's a debate, but it's an enemy who has attacked them. So most opinions will understand that this, what we're in right now, is a milchamet mitzvah. I did bring you Rashi in number 20, who says that the only milchamet mitzvah was the one of Yeshua, and after that there's no such thing as a milchamet mitzvah. You might hear that shita, there's no milchamet mitzvah anymore. That's difficult, because the Mishnah talks about the distinction between different kinds of milchama, milchamet rishut, milchamet mitzvah. So if they're all over at the time of Yeshua, then what's it talking about? And again, we can go into the depths of where Rashi's coming from, but the opinion of the Rambam is pretty much universal. I don't think you'll find in the Haredi community much argument as to whether we are or are not in a milchamet mitzvah. There may be some that say, well, Rashi said, okay. But the Rambam certainly says, and it seems to be muskam generally amongst pretty much everybody. There is a Rambam that says that it can't be a milchamet mitzvah without a Beis HaMikdash. It's a difficult Rambam. I brought it in number 24, but I'm not going to go into it now. Certainly Rav Tzvi Yehuda, Rav Goren, no surprises, held that what we're in since 1948, and even before, is a milchamet mitzvah. And you can read 22 and 23 in your own time. I've actually looked at them before in one of the chizuk sessions we had earlier in the year when we were just after October 7th, where Rav Shlomo Goren and Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook say, milchamet mitzvah, there are no exceptions. Everybody has to come. And it's an absolute duty. It's based on the mitzvah, lo tamod al dam riecha. You may not stand by while other Jews specifically are suffering. And therefore they see it clearly as a milchamet mitzvah. Question is, though, do Talmidei Chachamim need to come or not? So, what do we say about Chatan V'Kala? Well, is it Kal V'Chomer Talmidei Chachamim? If we even have to take the Chatan V'Kala, then of course we have to take the Talmidei Chachamim. Or do we say, no, the Chatan V'Kala, then we'll take. But Talmidei Chachamim is a different case altogether. You could read this in different ways. And actually, I brought you number 25, the Keren Ora. We had him last week. The Keren Ora was, I think, 18th century, 19th century. He was the one that said that we can depose the king. Remember, if we don't like the king anymore, well, not for now. That was last week. Says the Keren Ora, Mashma hacha de milchemet mitzvah hakol yotzin. Afilu talmid chacham tzrichin li batel milimudan. It's absolutely includes the Talmidei Chachamim, and the Sefer Aruch learns it as a Kal V'Chomer from Chatan V'Kala. Meaning, how can you take a Chatan V'Kala away from the Chuppah? If you even take them, you take everybody. You must take everybody. However, I brought you, and we'll probably have to end at number 29, but it's maybe just tack on the rest next time. We've made very good progress, Baruch Hashem. But I want to read you three more sources. First of all, the Tzitz Eliezer. Also not seen as a quote-unquote extremist on many issues. He says very clearly, number 27, Mizeh sha'amru zal b'sotah, shem b'sham b'lashom, when they said in sotah, aval b'mechemet mitzvah ha'kol yotzin afilu chatan b'chedro v'kala mechipotah, ein lomar d'bal rabot ha'kol yotzin afilu tamei chachamim. That doesn't include the tamei chachamim. V'zeh einu, u'b'ta'ut hazot huda d'ta'a asa ha'melech. We'll see him next time. That's a mistake that Asa made. We'll see Chazal talk about King Asa, that he did draft the Talmidei Chachamim and he shouldn't have done. So there are those that say no. However, I just want to leave you today with a very important topic. It could be there's something even bigger than a milchamet mitzvah. We've been arguing, do they have to come in a milchamet mitzvah, yes or no? But the Chazon Ish, who of course had that famous meeting with Ben-Gurion, which we'll look at next week, where they talked about the issue of the draft, and the Chazon Ish was like, laid down the law, no way. The Chazon Ish himself writes in number 28, Nira, seems to me, the Hadat Snan be Milchemet Mitzvah, when it talks about Milchemet Mitzvah, it says, Afilu Chatam Lechedro, Lo Airi, it is not talking about a situation, Bizman Shitzrichim Le'ezratan Le'Nitzachom HaMilchama, at a time when you need everybody to win the war. Does that pshita? Because it's absolutely obvious in that case. The bishvil pikuach nefesh, the hatzalat ta'am, kulu chayavim. Obviously, everybody has to come if we need everybody, or if we need another 1,000 or another 10,000. So that's not even a discussion. The chidush of the Gemara is, and the Mishnah is, even when they only need a specific number, you can take from the chatanim. But when you need everybody, then everybody's needed. Everyone has to come. Which is an interesting question. What does that mean, everybody's needed? How many people do we need now? I don't know the answer to that. When the army say they need X more, I mean, how many more is there? What are the enemies that we will, God forbid, have to face? Right now we're fighting Hamas. Hezbollah are on the border. Iran is around. And of course, the enemy that is never discussed but is at the back of everybody's mind is, of course, Egypt. What's going to be with Egypt? So you're going to say, Egypt? Egypt are our friends. Well, open up the Tanakh and see how that works. Now, Baruch Hashem, we're happy for our friends. But you've got right on the border one of the most strongly armed armies in the world with American weaponry, building roads through the Sinai for tanks that only have one purpose for the Egyptians. Okay? So how many men do we need? I don't know. Ask the army. In Hilchot Medina, even Rav Waldenberg, who said, you don't call the Talmid Chachamim, I want to leave you with this, says in number 29, Ubeze yesh lomar shegam harambam modeh, she'im nichlesu Yisrael lekrav shel mechemet mitzvah, if we go into a war, v'yesh sakana shel pikuach nefesh, im lo yikhu gam mirabanan, and there's a pikuach nefesh if we don't take from the rabbis, they absolutely have to go out to their brother's help. Your excuse for that, because it's after time. It's fine. Okay? And therefore, just be careful when people are throwing sources around. The Tzitz Eliezer says you can't draft the rabbis for a milchamet mitzvah. But he says, but if you need them, then that's even more than a milchamet mitzvah. And of course you draft the rabbis. So we have to work out what's our matzav. Please God, it'll be much better than we think it is. But we have to be plan ahead. And at the end of that source, he says, of course, we only draft people who know how to use a weapon. So, and that's a very important point, which is, if we're going to need people in a year, we can't call them up in a year when they've been sitting in yeshiva. We have to train them how to be fighters. So we have to actually plan ahead in this way. And this will be definitely part of the cheshbon. Anyway, to be continued, Bezrat Hashem. Have a good week. We'll continue next week.